Hello everyone, my name is Marshall and I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is March 9th, 2012, so I just hit the 10-year mark, which was pretty cool. Before I begin, just take a moment maybe to acknowledge and remembrance the day we're at here, 9/11, right? So 21 years ago, I lost a lot of good folks in a real tragedy. And it was 11 years before I made my way here. At the time, it was bittersweet for me. I remember I was married at the time, and my daughter, which turned out to be my one and only child, was born 18 days after that day. So it was really just, like I said, bittersweet. What I'm going to begin with is I'm going to tell a story. There's this one story in particular that threads throughout my drinking as well as my recovery. So I broke it up into three parts. This is going to be a three-part kind of workshop. And I'm going to begin each session with a piece of this story. And in the book, there's two main pieces of guidance that I use when I speak and I tell my story. The first one is on page 58 and how it works. And it's read in many, many meetings, right? So you hear it all the time. But how it goes is, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I just outlined thoroughly, right? Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves, right? Self-honesty is key, was key for me in this program. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. Our stories, it goes on to say, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, and that's what I'm going to tell today in this one particular story, what happened and what we are like now. So I'm going to give you like a cliffhanger story of the what I did and what it's like now will be in the next 2 weeks. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps, and we'll get into that more as we go through the workshop. And then the second piece I actually learned about, the second piece of guidance on how to speak and tell a story, I learned from this meeting. And it was before I took a commitment to speak on behalf of this meeting with Anita and this other guy, Mark N., back in early 2012. And Mark goes, Marshall, will you speak at this meeting? I go, I've never been at this meeting. And he said, yeah, just come along. And I said, sure. And I came along. And he goes, listen, the only thing you have to remember is that the story you tell has to have depth and weight. And I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. But that was one of the things. Back in those days, there was bookers, and this group used to take outgoing meetings. I had learned. So if you go to the doctor's opinion, right, on page XXVIII in my book, it says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. So that comes from Dave P. And I'd heard. And those are the two pieces of guidance when I tell a story. So here's part one of my story. I knew I had a drinking problem pretty much my entire life. I was a drunk for 3 decades. Kind of a functioning alcoholic. I was employed. I went to college and all those types of things. As the disease does, it progressed within me. And as I mentioned, right, I had this daughter. So I got married. I chilled out a little bit with the drinking. We had the child about 5 years later. And then I even took the crew to Australia. We lived in Australia for a number of years. For where it was my business that took me there. So it was pretty manageable up until a point. But this one major event happened, and that happened on June 20th, 2009. And then this is where my daughter went with her mother, who is Brazilian, from Brazil, on a planned trip to Brazil. And they never returned from that trip. So that was June 9th, 2019, and you would think, oh man, it's time to sober up and get my act together, but it was the complete opposite reaction from me, where I even drank more. It was as if, right now, the disease had full access to me. I didn't have to hide anything. So 2009, 10, 11, and early 2012 is really all a blur to me. I didn't go out much. It was mostly in isolated drinking inside. But it really was pathetic, and it was no existence, and it got to a point where I didn't want to be there. To compound things, about 10 months after the absconsion of my daughter, my mother, who was battling cancer, she passed away. So in a very short time, right, I had lost the two most important people in my lives, my daughter and my mother. And I just didn't know what to do. And I was just sad all the time, and I cried all the time. And I drank all the time. It's the only thing I knew to do to make me feel better. And I'd wake up each day and saying, I know I need to stop drinking, but today is not that day. Today is not that day, over and over again. And it really was just extreme alcoholic drinking all the time. I lost a couple jobs. I'd have jobs and lose jobs in that time. I'd never had any issues with drinking on the job or anything like that. And I actually didn't have an issue with that then. It's just like they could see I was just a mess and they let me go. It wasn't that I was drinking on the job. It's just I couldn't really function as a good employee anymore. And I was lost, and I really didn't want to be here. I wasn't suicidal. I don't remember being suicidal. But for whatever reason, on March 9th, 2012, I woke up one day. I said, I know I need to stop drinking, and today's that day. And what I did, it was very stupid, but I didn't know that they have wings of hospitals that help people detox from alcohol. And I had the shakes and the whole, I was fully physically and mentally addicted to alcohol. And I just stopped drinking and stayed in my house. And it was very violent kind of rehab in that house. And I couldn't keep water down. I couldn't walk for several days. But once I did, I gave myself two choices. And this was critical to my recovery. I said, Marshall, you're going to either stop drinking, or if you can't, you're going to drink yourself to death. I said, however, and I meant this, I really meant this, that first option, quitting drinking, you're going to give it your best try. You are going to go all in. It's your best effort. And that's what you're going to give to that. And if you fail, fine, then you're going to drink yourself to death. And I didn't know this at the time, but what I was displaying, right, was the sheer willingness required for this program, right? I had that. So I wanted to focus in on the book and willingness, right? So the book talks a lot about willingness. It was a key ingredient to my recovery. So on page 12, on the fourth paragraph, starts with it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. Well, doesn't that work out nicely? Because that's all I had. I was on my own will, my own steam, my own power. That's it. But I had this willingness, right? I said that. This is going to be my best, the best I got. in my beginning. I saw that growth, right? And then I've just learned, right? I'm either growing or I'm not. I'm either growing or I'm dying, right? And this growth could start from that point. And it did. It really did. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, which I had, I might build what I saw in my friend, and it's Bill talking about his friend Abby. Would I have it? Of course I would. If you go to the bottom of page 12, there had been a humble willingness to have him, capital H, with me. And he, capital H, came. I allowed myself... I wrote some notes for myself, but I think more of it, like he was always there, and I was waking up. I was beginning to see the truth of my own experience, my own existence. If we go to page 28 in the chapter of There Is a Solution, in the second paragraph, we in our turn sought the same escape with all desperation of drowning men. And I love that description. Of drowning. That's how I felt at the end. I was a drowning man, flailing away, didn't have a clue what to do. Only thing that made me feel better was alcohol. I need help. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And I think of that like a little candle, right? This connection to God, and I'm protecting it because that's all I had with what little I had, and then the growing, right? Just keep growing and growing, and then from that, the light will shine. A new life has been given us. Or if you prefer, a design for living, right? Like a blueprint for living. That's what this program was for me. It was foundational for everything. It was a springboard for everything that really works. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. And that's fortunate for me, because I really didn't have any relationship with God. And if somebody was to force a way down upon me, I don't know how that would have gone. But that's not the program. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. And I love that term, like a child of God, just considering myself a child of God and considering each of you a child of God. And it just makes me feel good to be a child of God. Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. And then on page 58, the second paragraph, which I've already read, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. So that's some guidance on willingness from the book. And I think it was just critical for me, because that's really all I had at the time. I'm going to tell you some more stuff. Like some miraculous things happened as soon as my willingness got me here. So as soon as I detoxed, I went to an intensive outpatient program. They encouraged me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I went, and then my very first meeting, it was a day off from the IOP, and the whole notion of God seemed impossible to me. I just didn't have that relationship. I had tried as a child. I even went to Bible camp one time. My parents were like atheist or agnostic. I don't know exactly. But it certainly wasn't a priority for them. But I had tried on my own, and I just didn't connect. But I knew it was riddled within the... I'd read the steps by this point, right? And I knew that God was a component of the program. And when I'm saying that like it's a little component. I realize it's everything now, but at the time I didn't realize that. So I go to my first AA meeting, and they ask, "Is anybody here in their first, second, or third AA meeting?" And I raise my hand, and I was the only man that raised his hand, and there was like three women that raised their hand as well. And I just said, "Hi, my name's Marshall. I'm an alcoholic." At the first time, felt a little weird. And then people would share. And then this one guy, and I'll just mention too that my father was an alcoholic. He never, as far as I know, he never did a program of recovery. He was like a doctorate kind of guy. He was very intellectual, very smart guy. And I don't want to, you know, paint a picture of him that's not true, but I believe he may have over intellectualized recovery. He quit on his own. He didn't live much in his 60s years of age. He lived a few more years and then passed away prior to being 70. But anyways, this guy that was speaking at my first meeting, his name was George. My father's name was George, so I made a mental kind of construct of that or connection of that just to remember the guy's name. And the guy gets up and he just said all these powerful things. And he said, "This is a program of honesty, right? It's a program of honesty, self-honesty. But you got to do the work." And I didn't know what the work was. I didn't have a clue. But I was willing. So I said, "No problem. I'll do whatever that work is." But not knowing what that work was. And you can do anything you want. Oh, that's nice. You can't drink. You just can't drink, but you can do anything you want. He said a lot of nice, lot of powerful things. And here's the kicker, right? This is my first AA meeting, and I learn 2 months later that this guy has the same first and last name as my dead alcoholic father, as if this guy is just like my dad's, "Marshall, don't do what I did, man. Listen to this man." And that's my first AA meeting. So I get my first God shot, like a real powerful one in that. So even though I found out 2 months later. This guy is local to our area, and he helps a lot of people with his program. He goes to a lot of meetings, and he's always there to lend a hand up. And I always let him know. I tell this story. He lets me use his name and stuff. He doesn't care about anonymity. He likes hearing it. Matter of fact, we had the same anniversary month, and we shared in this room in March. We both have March. So I share that story. And my sponsor also has a March meeting. It was just the three of us celebrating, right? And I was the first to go, even with 10 years, because I guess people aren't celebrating as much anymore. So I mention him first, and I go, "Whenever I see George, I see the loving hand of God putting out a hand to lift up the alcoholic," like that. And after I finished up at the end of the meeting, he goes, you made me cry, you bastard." And that touched my heart, because, you know, he's a tough nut to crack. But he was touched, and I always am touched, because I get teared up just thinking about it. So then I go to my second AA meeting, and then there was this woman, young woman, and she's just telling the story about how she mastered step one, skipped the God part in step two and three, and went on to step four and five, right, and did her inventory. And she woke up in a coma in New Orleans, right, from here, after going on a binge, right, on the spree. And I only bring that up to just say, hey, I learned right away. I don't know if I would have done anything to do steps out of order, but I got information that's not the way to go in that second meeting. And then in my soon after, I got involved. So the direction I received from George was, hey, you go to a lot of meetings, and I was doing that, and I took to the meetings. I loved the meetings right off the bat. I was just a sponge for the information. You get a home group, and I did that. You get a sponsor, and I did that. And you take a commitment, and I did that, right? So I did that all in kind of one meeting, and it wasn't very difficult. It wasn't hard work. So that was the beginning work, and it wasn't very hard. And then with the sponsor, right, I was fortunate in that my sponsor took me directly to this book. And what we did is we went through this book in private. He'd come to my house. I was living alone at this point, right? He'd come to my house on a set time every week. And that was critical time, right, to go through this book and these steps and this work. And then he would suggest meetings. And I, of course, would meet him at all the meetings. On Thursdays, we'd go to a meditation meeting. On Fridays, we went to a 10-step meeting. 10-step, I was just starting. I didn't know what it was, but I used to joke that I'm a 10-step specialist early on because I used to focus in on the 10th step. And then Saturday, we'd have our home group, which was a big kind of social meeting, which was good. And then I found this meeting about a few months into my recovery. And this meeting was a game changer. I'd start coming to this meeting and I'd see all of these people, enlightened people, speaking freely about God. And I was like, how do they do that? How do they just talk about God so freely when I'm just starting this relationship. I go, man, they must be, you know, it must take forever to do that. But here I am today talking about trusting God is the topic of this big book workshop. And it's something that once the relationship is blossoming, it's just easy to talk about because I realize it saved my life. And another story I tell about this meeting is there was a guy, his name's Barefoot Bill, and he was just here a few weeks ago, Barefoot Bill, right? And he has a lot of interesting facts about the history of AA, and he tells different things. But back in 2012, I saw him in this meeting, and he shared something like this, and I'm totally paraphrasing. I don't want to put any like notion of what he said, but what I heard anyways, what I heard him say was that, have you ever tried to talk to God out loud, speak to God out loud? He goes, you might feel a little goofy when you first do it, but he goes, when you do it, you know, miraculous things may happen, put it that way. And I was like, cool, like I have an action item from this meeting, this big book meeting. And it just so happened I was unemployed when I came in here. It's about 6 months in. It was August of 2012 that I heard Barefoot Bill talk about praying out loud. I had a final interview, so it was like the fifth, sixth interview at this company out of San Francisco. With the CEO, it's like the rubber stamp type of interview. So what I do is I go home after that meeting and I have a conversation with God. And it was as Bill said, right? I say, dear God, if there's anything else I need to do, I am willing to do it. Please, please help me. Please show me. Please help me to be at my best for this interview. And I felt goofy at first, but then I just started weeping, right? I'm just like, it felt like, hey, I'm talking to God, and I just felt something. And I think that was a Sunday, and then it was a Tuesday I had this interview, and I heard this guy. I come from a classical musical family, not me, my everybody else, brother, sister, mother, father, classical musicians. I heard this guy's a jazz pianist, right? The CEO of this company. And I also had this idea, it was like, it's going to be a virtual meeting with San Francisco CEO, to put my, I have a piano in my house, to put my laptop on my piano. So instead of like being at a table and looking down at the thing, to be like looking up at him, it was like a matter of respect, just like a little thing I did, I came up with. And then as I'm talking to him, music makes its way into the conversation. And he's telling me about it. And I go, yeah. I go, as a matter of fact, I'm speaking for my piano right now. He goes, oh, yeah, what kind of piano do you have? I go, I have a Mason and Hamlin piano. Mason and Hamlin, for hundreds of years, is a handmade piano out of Boston. I didn't know this so much at the time. I think I knew that much. He goes, oh, really? My first job, I sold Mason and Hamlin pianos. And they still make them today, and I have like this 1940 piano. It's a beautiful instrument. I keep it up and everything like that. But the conversation's going like that. So the point of the story is I talked to God, and good things happened. I did get that job, and I worked there for a number of years. And it was a great entry job into a re-entry job, I mean, just to get back in the game. But it was an action item from this meeting directly. Once I started coming to this meeting, and even before, I asked myself two questions, right? Two main questions. What's wrong with me? What is the disease of alcoholism? And what do I need to do to recover? And the answers and the things that I'm going to focus on for today's talk is, one is what I knew. I need to change, right? I thought at the time that change was to just stop drinking. But it's much deeper than that, really down into my soul. And we'll get into that. And what I learned is, why do I need to change? Because I lack power. I was running on my own steam. I was failing miserably. The only thing that made me feel better was alcohol. Alcohol is the solution to alcoholism. It's just a terrible solution. And I was dying. So if you go to the book, right on page III, the title page, I just like to point this out as it was pointed out to me in this meeting. It says, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. So right in the beginning, before we're even reading any chapter, we're on the title page and we're seeing that, hey, many thousands of people, and of course many more by now, of men and women have recovered, and it says the word recovered. When I came in here in 2012, there was a lot of controversy over the word recovered and recovering and all that stuff, but I remember, that doesn't seem so confusing to me. Why is everybody all mad about this word? And then somebody read the definitions in here, and then it made perfect sense, and I never really thought it about again. If people want to fight and bicker about it, love and tolerance is my code, and you guys do what you got to do. So I'll just do that now, right? So I look it up, recovering, being in the process of overcoming a disorder or shortcoming. Back then, I was recovering from alcoholism. And then the word recovered, I have two different definitions. I'm sure there are others. The first one is return to a normal state of health, mind, or strength. All that happened. I was doing all that. My strength was getting better, my health was getting better, and my mind was getting saner. Or to found or regained possession of something stolen or lost. All that happened. I found faith. I regained sanity. And much, much more. All that happened. So it's a process. Takes what it takes. And as the book says on page 85, what we really have is a daily... It's a 10-step information. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So with that, I'm going to focus now on those two things, right? Change. I need to change. Why? Because I lack power. Change in power. If you go to Doctor's Opinion, page XIII, it's the foreword to the first edition. It's not the Doctor's Opinion. It's the foreword to the first edition. This is the foreword as it appeared in the first printing of the first edition in 1939. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Right? That's just in the foreword of the book. We're not even into the book. Paragraph 5 on the same forward. We are not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. Now, when it says the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking, it doesn't say you have to do this book, right? It doesn't say that. It says just that. The only way I know to recover is by going through this program, because that's what I did, and that's what I can coach somebody through or sponsor somebody through if they choose, if they're willing. But also, right, the only time I'll say something to someone politely is if they're taking this program and making up their own, something that's not in here. But for me to be able to do that, I have to know this book, and that's why I just over and over and over, I go through it with people I work with, I go through it myself, I go through it especially in this meeting. So I just point that out, right? However you're doing it, it's really none of my business. Because you just really have to have an honest desire to stop drinking, and that's it. Now to the doctor's opinion, which is page XXVII in the fifth paragraph. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. So right there, that gives us direction, right? Whenever it says at once, right, we're doing these things immediately. So I mentioned before, you hear things in here like you do a step a year and that kind of stuff. That's just a made-up thing. So if I hear that, right, I'll just point out that it doesn't actually say that in the book. And you can point to things like, hey, we put this into practical application at once. We're doing these things immediately. We're not rushing through them, right? And that's why you get a qualified sponsor to work with you to go through this work. So that they can help you measure the pace. But you want, if you had cancer, do you want your medicine now, or do you want it, you know, a year from now? Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive. And I was amazed, right? I came in here. Nobody ever asked me for money, right? They passed a basket and never asked me for money. I was like, this is different than hanging in the city. They really just, everybody was loving and wanted to be helpful. And it's like, hey, I'm in the right place. And their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more in the power, capital P, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. From the gates of death. I was pulled from the gates of death. That fits me to a T. Further in the doctor's opinion, page XXVIII in the second paragraph, which I already read. I'll just read a little more. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So we need to ground ourselves in a power greater than ourselves, is what this book is telling me. On the same page, fourth paragraph, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That was certainly the case for me. The sensation is so elusive, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. It was like Groundhog Day, just drinking and passing out, waking up, drinking. Passing out. And I did that for years, for those 9, 10, 11, 12, all those years. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through a well-known stage of esprit, of, spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. When I first came in here, I thought the change was, I need to stop drinking. How do I do that? But I begin to learn that I am needing a entire psychic change, and psychic is relating to the soul or the mind. But it's a deep change. It goes well beyond just changing a behavior or two. And the other thing that I wrote here is, as my own notes, is like, there's lots of neuroscience going here, and I was wondering, when was neuroscience ever used as a term? And it first was kind of coined in 1962 by Harvard Medical Center. So I studied, as well after I recovered, right, I started getting into neuroscience and the autonomic nervous system and just kind of this, which is our safety system, and why do I feel safe or unsafe and that type of thing. And I just want to, maybe as we go along, just kind of introduce some things that I learned, because this is like touching into deep neuroscience, right, without knowing, like, you know, Phil and Bob didn't know what that was because it wasn't a thing yet, or maybe Dr. Bob, you know, knew about something, but it wasn't even a word, right, until 1962. Continuing on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, I seem doomed, who had so many problems, I had problems, he despaired of ever solving, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Now I don't even think about alcohol. I wouldn't put alcohol in me if you paid me very large amounts of money. I just wouldn't. I don't think about it. I don't desire it. It's just miraculous, right? And that's been a long time, right? But I have this daily reprieve. Growing, not dying. Growing, spiritually growing, not dying. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Right? And I hear it in the meetings a lot, that people will seek psychiatric help, which didn't help with the alcohol problem, right? It may be helping with other things. Not to say that it does or doesn't, but I've just heard it in meetings as an experience. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control, right? I didn't know what the problem was, but I didn't know I had no control of it, right? Why? Because I lacked power. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And I said it earlier, right? Alcohol was my solution to alcoholism, right? It was just a very bad one. It worked every time until it didn't, right? In the beginning, it was kind of fun, right? For 10 years or whatever. Then it became like just to kind of manage things. And then it became unmanageable. I was powerless pretty much the whole time, and at some point it became unmanageable. Once both those things are true, that's when I need outside source of power. Go to page 24. There is a solution in the first new paragraph. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are able at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're doing this over and over. I was doing this over and over again. We are without defense. I had no defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare. And I just put a note. Threadbare is used so often it is no longer effective. Idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how." Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. Right? And I was doing the same things over and over. It was the same behavior, the same breakdowns. It's causing more and more damage, justifying it in my mind, because that's all I had was my mind, my own willpower, and then back to it day over day over day. For decades. Right? How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sake, how did I ever get started again?" Only to have that thought supplanted by, "Well, I'll stop with the sixth drink," or "What's the use anyway?" When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But that's where I was headed, right? I was going to die or go insane. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching. The leveling of our pride, right? Pride is a big one, right? This is my way. I need to be right. This is how people should do things. This way I got. Got to get rid of that. And I'm still doing it, right? That's a lifelong process, right? I get triggered, go to my head, take a breath, get into my body, peace, right? And just once it's awareness, right? I'm aware that I'm doing that. I'm aware that I have these conditioning, things I was conditioned to believe. And from the conditioning, I created these conclusions, right? This is the way it is and this is the way it isn't. And then I just build the scaffolding, right? And when something goes up against my scaffolding, it triggers my ego mind. And then my ego mind, once it's triggered, what it used to happen is chug-a-lug, right? Ah, and I'm better, I feel better. But now, it's just a trigger. I go, and after a lot of practice, right, I can just take a breath, center myself in my lower belly, and just be. And that's the difference, right? And that's when I say neuroscience, right? It's a new way of thinking where, you know, it's like everything. Like, you want to go fishing? Yeah, because I can drink. You want to go golfing? You want to go bowling? You want to go do yard work? You want to go watch a baseball game? You could name it, right? And it's always accompanied by drinking. With people, without people, I didn't care. It was just always drinking. Right now, it's just like, if I'm triggered, I just take a breath and I'm there. And that's through just like through practice, right? And then take a breath and breathe God in. I forget where I was, so. I'll just read, but we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the helplessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to do but to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet, right? And that's what we learn in the book. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed
rocketed
into a fourth dimension of existence in which we had not ever dreamed, right? This is beyond my wildest dreams, right? Not only that I'm here and alive and I can breathe, right? But it's just like, it's exponentially better year over year over year, day over day over day. I just can't believe it's me. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had a deep and effective spiritual experiences, with an asterisk and an explanation later in the book, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and to God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. If you are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. Right? I said in the beginning, I was going to give it my best effort, so I wasn't going for the middle of the road solution. I didn't know that at the time, but that was very helpful to me. And one thing, I just made a note for myself too. I've noticed when I sponsor people, one thing that I caution them on is we don't want to disengage from the practices and the principles that we've learned here. If we disengage too soon, we're liable to return to our ego mind. It really took me, from my experience, a lot of not disengaging from it and just keeping the pedal on the metal as far as working with others, keeping commitments, doing big book workshops and learning about what's wrong with me and what do I need to do to recover and that type of thing. So just it was a long haul type of thing for me. It wasn't like I'm going to stop drinking. At first it was like I just want to stop drinking, but it became a long haul thing where I'm in this for the rest of my life. And you know, at some point it went from the word work to just a sheer joy, miracle, amazing, miraculous. And that's what it's kind of describing here, the way of life. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. So the acceptance of spiritual help just happened kind of organically for me, just because of the willingness. On page 43, the second paragraph, many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, and I was looking it up, his name is Dr. Percy Poliak. Any of you guys historians? I thought it would be Silkworth, but then I was looking, it's Dr. Percy Poliak. Staff member of a world-renowned hospital recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless. 100% hopeless! I wonder if I would have gotten that from Dr. Poya. 100% hopeless. Apart from divine help, had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. We break people's hearts. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Higher power. And then on page 45, we agnostics, in the first full paragraph, lack of power. When I work with guys, I always say, do you know what your problem is? And they always go, I don't know. Until I get them, I go, your problem is you lack power. And I'll do it right before we're going to read this part, because it says it, right? What's your fundamental problem? Lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than us ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its meta object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. And that's what we're talking about mostly in the first section of this workshop, since it's called Trust God. And then if we go to page 50, we agnostics in the bottom of the page. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves to take certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things that has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements, once fused and baffled by the seemingly futility of existence. They show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Right? And it keeps saying, like, there's simple requirements, there's simple rules, right? There's simple stuff. And we get into that as we go, but first we're just building up to this point that, hey, I was running on my own fume, my own will. It wasn't enough. It nearly killed me. I was sad and crying every day. Unemployed, broke. I'm broken. And I needed to change. Why? Because I lacked power, the power of choice. Then if we go to page 52, we agnostics, the second paragraph, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? And one of the reasons I put this in this talk is that word bedevilments. When I first started coming to this meeting, I didn't know what bedevilments were. Somebody came here, I think Dave asked this woman to speak about the bedevilments, right? And she just did a whole lecture on bedevilments. And it turns out there's 9 bedevilments mentioned here, right? If you count those out, there's 9 bedevilments. And I go back to my sponsor, and he wasn't 100% sure on bedevilments, right? He had a book, and he looked it up, and the bedevilments, and then he and I discussed bedevilments the rest of our time together at that meeting, that one-on-one meeting, right? But it was just so cool how this meeting, like, led to all this, like, knowledge. And my sponsor had 2 years, right, when I came in, and he was the perfect guy for me, but it's just because he got me right to this book. And I'm still with him. He's a great friend. But it's just like this meeting just led to so much, like, growth. So I just wanted to kind of review the first 3 steps is what we're covering with in the opening of the book, in the first many chapters of the book. First step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Right? There's a dash in between those two things, the powerlessness and the unmanageability. Are both of those things true for me? Right? And I could just look at myself and I was powerless over alcohol. I'd take a drink, I couldn't stop, right? I could maybe quit for a week or two if I really, really, really tried, and I didn't do that very often. But once I took a drink, it was all bets were off, right? All bets were off. Or if I was at work and everybody was like having a Friday beer or something like that, I'd drink the beer. I could control it, but it would be painful to do it. That type of stuff. That was I knew in the back of my mind, I'll get somewhere where I can really get the vodka, not the beer, and just go to town. As long as I knew that, I could kind of control it. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I heard a guy in here I was sober 5 years or whatever it was, right? And this guy goes, the way this is written, came to believe. It's not like you come here and you just automatically believe, right? It's through this process. You just kind of gently, you came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, right? And you just came through the process. Not like any force. You don't have to do anything. Just. And then number three, right? Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him, right? So when I was given that choice, it's a yes or no question. I say yes to that. Do the third step prayer. I'm still giving my life and my will over to the care of God because I don't see everything, right? It's a process. It's unfolding. So the more I go, the more I grow, the more I keep to this foundation and these principles, the more I'm just going to continue to see. Once I see, I can do something about it. But if I'm blind to it, right? Every time I'm triggered, like I said about pride, that still happens. Not as often, right? Because once you see it, then you see it. Then it's in the light. Right, and it's all about this connection to God that I nurture, and that's what's given me that. So I guess it's kind of 10-minute mark. Do you want me to open it up for questions or anything like that?
No, that sounds good.
Comments? Okay.